Durch Deutschland geht ein tiefer Riss, der spaltet die Nation. Ne Neuheit ist das nicht gewiss, doch von Interesse schon. Das Beispiel Krupp und Krause klärt den wirklichen Verlauf der deutschen Spaltung zugehört als Klassenfrage auf.
Denn Krupp ist Monopolherr und Krause ist Prolet. Das ist der Klassengegensatz, den jedermann versteht.
Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the Young Hegelians podcast. With us today, we've got Allison.
Hello.
We've got Young.
What's up?
And myself, Zia. And we're going to be going over the book Capitalist Realism by Mark Fisher.
So the central thesis of capitalist realism, or capitalist realism in a nutshell, is that it's the idea that capitalism and elements of capitalism are so ingrained in us that it's easier to imagine just like the extinction of humanity than that system actually ending or being superseded in any way.
It's either I think it was Frederick Jameson who said it first, or I don't really know, but it was Frederick Jameson and Zizek said it around the same time. One of them said it first, obviously. And it was in reference to this cultural outpouring of these movies, like disaster movies, end of the world movies, like 2012 movies, like Michael Bay's entire oeuvre, zombie movies, up the wazoo. And this was all coming around at the time of the financial crisis, 2007. And from 2007, 2011, there was quite a bit of civil and social unrest and whatever. But at the same time, there was this sort of long overhang of despair. And so the thesis was just that, yeah, like it's almost comforting for us to imagine the end of the world, especially in light of climate change and so on, than it is because it's just capitalism has become hegemonic, and it's naturalized itself so effectively that there's no horizon beyond it. So, and since capitalism is inconsistent with the continuation of the human species, as with climate change, therefore it is a logical deduction for that would be that it actually is easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism.
It's that tendency just, you know, like actualized.
Right. It's funny, it's a lot of people have now made this point. Just as a tangent, like Latour says, you know, it used to be that nature was fixed and culture was malleable, but now we have geoengineering and genetic engineering and climate change, but we have the hegemony of neoliberalism, so now culture and society seems fixed, but nature is malleable. That's like the same idea. As I was saying before, I actually don't like this because I just don't like slogans in general, but first, mostly it's because it is accurate, I think, with regard to this generalized malaise and phenomenon of disaster and zombie movies. And I think as a general description of people, of most people, and of, I don't know, for lack of a better word, because I don't actually believe this exists, our cultural unconscious, I think it's probably valid. It's like, you know, an impressionist painting, the more closer you look at it, it becomes a bunch of squiggly lines. And my central problem with it is that, first of all, it's, you know, what is it, like 30 to 40% of millennials say they prefer socialism to capitalism. And I know we all know that that's like a whatever statistic, but
well, especially because
Bernie is socialist,
right?
Right, but it goes back to the point that I made in the pre-pod discussion, which was just that people can imagine the end of capitalism when they're not really doing it,
right? I don't know. I mean, we saw lots of outpourings of things, you know, Occupy or whatever. I mean, that's a while ago now, but for a while, what is it? Das Kapital, and then later Piketty's Capital is so funny, where like the bestsellers are on Amazon's economics. I mean, the soothsayers like to read evidence from these, even though they're stupid statistics. Anyway, it's just in my experience is that it is actually very easy for people to imagine the end of capitalism. But most of the time when I hear people imagine the end of capitalism, what they describe is just like capitalism. I don't know. It's like this weird petty bourgeois fantasy.
Yeah.
Everybody has a house and a car and a dog and a job and a wife or whatever. Everybody has a wife. State assigned their wives. And then, and works 9 to 5. And
even the wives have wives.
Yeah, well, oh, of course. There's one long chain of, that way no one has exclusive my wife privilege to say, you know, my wife. Anyway, please edit this part out. you know, a sticky point I have with a lot of socialists, and I don't want to really get this entire debate, we'll have a whole episode on it, is like, you know, focusing on the state and prisons and work and extractivism and enclosure.
Those are other institutions that people naturalize to a degree, where it's like, we're these radical leftists, we're the communists, but in the name of, you know, rejecting idealism in favor of something more realistic, you'll often see Marxists that are like, getting rid of the family? Sounds like idealism, even though it's like in the Communist Manifesto.
It's also like, it doesn't even, like, getting rid of the, abolishing the family in the sense that leftists use it, doesn't mean we're gonna go, like, with the fucking police, force couples to divorce or whatever. It's
like, no, that's what I mean.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess we could do it, but, and then we have to make gay marriage mandatory.
But that goes without saying. That's
of course,
just
funny. Of course.
I mean, I did my part already, like, with that whole thing.
Yeah.
So, those things are, like, naturalized, in my experience, even more intensely, because even leftists who clearly critique capitalism, as you say, also will naturalize those things. And they share that naturalization with liberals and so on.
But the problem with that perspective, I find, is that in every case, you're talking about leftists who, quote-unquote, have a critique of capitalism, but accept institutions like the police force. Except when you look at these communists that believe in the eternal police force, they don't really have very good critiques of capitalism at all.
I mean, that's probably true. As a general rule, like, this phenomenon is going to be found more among social democrats and MLs. You know, without starting any left-wing infighting here.
Why did you repeat yourself?
Their relationship to leftism as such, or Marxism, or communism as such, is, you know, tendentious at times. But, you know, don't worry, I love all my social democratic and Marxist-Leninist MUFOs and IRL friends, don't worry.
I think we did the song and dance last episode.
No, the difference is I don't anymore.
Oh, okay. Right.
And the pushback, you know, on some of these things like prison, work, and extractivism, like the pushback people and the state that people give when you say, well, why not critique these two? I mean, it's always very intense and very emotional in my experience. It's kind of weird. There's another thing, too, which is that if we're going to be like Gramscians or Althusserians or whateverians or Lefkons, you know, we have this idea that, like, you know, the horizon of our imagination is almost certainly constrained by the current system of capitalist relations. And in that sense, it's true that it might be easier to imagine the end of capitalism, the end of the world. That's, in some sense, a feature, not a bug. And the whole point is, in the insurrectionary literature, the IT always goes, the whole point of this rupture is that it creates this new space for relating and imagining in ways that were totally unconceived of before. But you don't have to be an insurrectionary to think that that's, like, a cool idea.
Yeah, one of the many things that draws me towards, like, organizing with anarchists to begin with.
I remember reading an article on Commune magazine about that Ursula Le Guin novel that people always recommend.
The Dispossessed?
Yeah, Dispossessed. And one of the points that they brought up about it that was very, very interesting to me was the idea that it's fictional, but it makes communism seem like a very real, possible society. And it does this by not presenting it as the end of problems for people to deal with. It's not that there's a final solution. That's not
there's no utopia. Oh, yeah.
Yes, all things. It's like human struggles can, the form changes after the abolition of class society, but, you know, there's still stuff to be done, right?
Yeah, there's still going to be heartbreak and conflict and logistical issues, and society, even a utopia, can ossify. So they're a stateless, egalitarian society. But at the beginning of the book, like, it's like basically their society has become moribund. I mean, it's equal and it's all this stuff in name only, but it's like not so great to live in. It's all rote and ritualized, and it has none of this, like, whatever. And then the main character is like a physics genius, and he gets thrown into the politics of this other planet, which has, like, this global north, global south, and and second world dynamic, and, you know, revolutions in their society, because he creates this thing called the Ansible, which allows cross whatever. And then that also reciprocally alters his society that he's from as well, and sort of reignites the juices of whatever, of revolution or revolutionary
right.
dreaming, at least. And yeah, anyway, I like that idea a lot, actually.
One of the interesting things that this book does is, I think it starts pretty much every chapter with a reference to media, usually something well-known.
Which is one way to explain Deleuze or whatever, right? Just, like, talk about movies instead, or also.
You look at something like that book, and compare it to something like V for Vendetta, they're just miles different in, like, so many important ways. The obvious one is how it seems like that society conceives of revolution as a spirit bomb. everyone come out on the right
in
day.
Which is the metaphor
that we would always use for, like, idealism, you know, lend me your power, right. You know, thoughts and prayers consolidating into, like, a ball of energy. But they do,
well,
like, this pseudo
material
version of that, which is, you know, everybody walks up to the state building at once, and then, like, the revolution is won without a single shot fired, just because, you know, we're so popular that the corrupt government
realizes the error of their ways.
In Vendetta, they do blow up the whatever they put.
But that's like a purely symbolic thing. Like, well, it's not like that was like
they
a.
They also break into the house.
Power.
They break into the.
Well, that was like
they kill the dictator, like, don't they?
They do, but, like, that also kind of reinforces the idea that, oh, you just gotta get rid of a few bad people, right? I don't get me wrong, I actually like the movie, just for different reasons now.
It's one of those movies like Fight Club, which can be enjoyed at a very, like, juvenile phase in somebody's life, but I think that there's still, like, genuinely, there's still something to like there when you grow up. You appreciate the film differently.
Yeah.
And, well, I mean, it's like, okay, the author, the guy who wrote, what's his name, Alan Moore, right? V for Vendetta, is that? Or is he Alan?
Yeah.
I always get Alan Moore, Alan Grant, and Grant Morrison confused. I've committed comic heresy. Alan Moore, yeah. You know, Alan Moore, when he said, I wrote the comic as about anarchism versus fascism and as an allegory for Thatcherism, whereas the movie is about liberalism versus American neoconservatism. So he's like he said,
yeah.
He actually didn't like the movie as a result. And I think that's, like, a more fair thing, is that it's like the liberal Wachowski interpretation of anarchism versus, like, a fascistized, made fascist neoconservatism.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, as a young neocon. Anyway, I don't know. I mean, Children of Men, I think, is a, you know, Zizek actually sold me on that movie, because I didn't like it when I was a kid, but Zizek made me like it, and I like it more than V for Vendetta now. That one's, like, interesting, because it's like a society with no history, right? The idea is that England is a country doesn't have, like, a constitutional, doesn't have some, like, guaranteed order. Its guaranteed order comes from its relationship to history, like, through, like, the common law. And so without any children in the future, there's no continuation of the species, and therefore there's no sort of, like, tie to history. And so, like, but everything carries on rote and procedurally and whatever. And Fisher talks about this too, like, that it all is just rote and procedural, and everybody just does it, and no one's even questioning it as the world burns and so on. And it's all out of view, but everything is just sullen and broken and shitty and fascistic. And everybody's hopeless. They can't even see the reason for living anymore. There's no continuation. I don't know. Anyway, let me find
He talks about the temporality of, like, the end of humanity in a very interesting way, too, where it's not that the event is behind us or in front of us. It's that we are amidst decline, and it's the sort of decline that we could easily imagine our own society being in at this moment through the idea that nothing really changes.
Yeah, the more things change, the more it's like kind of this kind of, like, intro level rote cynicism that's just a hand waving excuse for complacency. Whatever. I just mixed complacency and complicity or whatever. But anyway, the passage in Capitalist Realism, he says, the widespread sense that not only is capitalism the only viable and political economic system, but also now that it is impossible to even imagine a coherent alternative to it. Once dystopian films and novels were exercised as such acts of imagination, the disasters they depicted acting as narrative pretext for the emergence of different ways of living. Not so in Children of Men. The world that it projects seems more like an extrapolation or exacerbation of ours than an alternative to it. In its world, as in ours, ultra-authoritarianism and capital are by no means incompatible. Internment camps and franchise coffee bars coexist. In Children of Men, public space is abandoned, given over to uncollected garbage and stalking animals. One especially resonant scene takes place in a derelict school through which a deer runs. Neoliberals, the capitalist realist par excellence, have celebrated the destruction of public space, but contrary to their official hopes, there is no withering away of the state in Children of Men, only a stripping back of its state to its core military and police functions. I say official hopes, since neoliberalism surreptitiously relied on the state system, even while it has ideologically excoriated it. This was made spectacularly clear during the banking crisis of 2008. Anyway, the catastrophe of Children of Men is neither waiting down the road, nor has it already happened. Rather, it is being lived through. There is no punctual moment of disaster. The world doesn't end with a bang. It winks out, unravels, gradually falls apart. What caused the catastrophe to occur, who knows? Its cause lies long in the past, so absolutely detached from the present as to seem like the caprice of a malign being, a negative miracle, a malediction which no penitence can ameliorate. Such a blight can only be eased by an intervention that can no more be anticipated than was the onset of the curse in the first place. Action is pointless. Only senseless hope makes sense. Superstition and religion, the first resorts of the helpless proliferate, connects with the suspicion that the end has already come. But now we only have reiteration, repermutation, no breaks, no shocks of the new. There must be something, the weak messianic hope that there must be something new in the way, lapses into morose conviction that nothing new can ever happen. We do not need to wait for Children of Men's near future to arrive to see the transformation of culture into museum pieces. Power of capitalist realism derives from the way that capitalism subsumes and consumes all of previous history. One effect of its system of equivalence, which can assign all cultural objects, whether they are religious iconography, pornography, or Das Kapital, a monetary value. But this, I mean, this is actually good because it does literally link all the main themes of the book.
Yeah, it does it really well too. I think like the next media reference he goes into is WALL-E, which I found really interesting. I haven't actually watched the film myself. I've just seen, you know, scenes from it that everyone posts around.
WALL-E is like an environmentalist film. It's about how humanity has gone on a voyage in space away from a planet that they've completely destroyed environmentally. Earth is just a garbage planet, and all like plants are dead on it. But the way that people, humanity is almost like on a cruise. It's like a vacation.
Yeah.
The ship that they're on is this consumerist paradise where everyone is horribly obese. Nobody ever talks to each other except through social media. And it seems like nobody has a job. Like there's no wage labor. Just consumption.
Well, it's like the Matrix, right? Their wage labor is their consumption. like, you know what I'm saying? Like, would say, like it's power. It is powered by the desires themselves. You know, it's like, you know, it's funny too. It's like, you know, Robert Nozick. You know, he's a libertarian philosopher, and he has the thought experiment of the pleasure machine, and the pleasure machine would fully simulate reality and would give you all the pleasure you wanted or whatever, and like constantly, and it would have no hedonic treadmill because it would always escalate it and vary it sufficiently that you wouldn't accustom to it, and it would even simulate the satisfaction of problems through the solution of real challenges, so you don't even get that objection to it. And he says, you know, but people still are completely averse to this idea, right? Like, it's revolting, but what I think is funny that Nozick doesn't make the connect. Or I mean, he kind of does, but he doesn't. He's not self-aware enough to realize that like that is like the sine qua non of like what capitalism is. I don't know. I mean, he does kind of, because the whole point is he's responding to this like utilitarian, liberal utilitarian worldview, the vulgarization of it at least. And it's
was he responding to Rawls?
Well, it's more about utilitarians, right? Because with Rawls would say that he's a Kantian, not a utilitarian, despite him clearly integrating aspects of both. It says the primary thesis, if the primary thesis of hedonism is that pleasure is good, then any component of life that is not pleasurable, nothing increases well-being. Those, and most is held by many value theorists, but most famous by classical utilitarians. He attacks the thesis by a thought experiment, shows that if there's something other than So his idea is that just like we intuitively have a different idea of a value than simply pleasure. I mean, it's not. It's a really kind of like. It's a strong thought experiment, but it's a weak inference. Anyway, all I'm saying is it's interesting because to me it's like the pleasure machine. Well, I mean, actually, they talk about in The Matrix, the first iteration of it was a pleasure machine and people rejected it. So there, that's actually very interesting.
Right.
And that's like very similar to WALL-E. I mean, it's like somewhere between Black Mirror and Robert Nozick's experience machine. Anyway.
Yeah.
One interesting thing about the setting of WALL-E, though, it sort of reveals a lot of liberals' belief that, oh, we can just get to full automation with capitalism.
Right.
It seems to imagine that outcome where there's no longer a wage labor mechanism, but people are still in a consumer society, which makes it seem like they're buying products, right? They're constantly watching advertisements, but it's unclear whether there is, from what I recall, whether there's any actual sales. So it's like, is this a monetary society? Like, as a Marxist, I just have all these questions about what the fuck is going on in WALL-E.
It's social credit, comrade.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's like Black Mirror. So like they go, like they get paid for posting and then they buy food with that. Yeah.
I think that's literally it, isn't it?
Probably. If they bothered to answer the question, that would probably be what they... then they'd have alienated posting labor.
Right.
Oh my god.
No, we already have that. We already exploit my surpost value.
Surpost value.
But what is he? He says, what this treatment of environmental catastrophe illustrates is the fantasy structure on which capitalist realism depends. A presupposition that resources are infinite, that the earth itself is merely a husk, which capital can at a certain point slough off like a used skin, and that any problem can be solved by the market. In the end, WALL-E presents a version of this fantasy, the idea that infinite expansion of capital is possible, that capital can proliferate without labor, on the off-world ship. Axiom, all labor is performed by the robots, that the burning up of the Earth's resources is only a temporary glitch, and that after a suitable period of recovery, capital can terraform the planet and recolonize it. Yet environmental catastrophe features in late capitalist culture only as a kind of simulacrum, its real implications for capitalism too traumatic to be assimilated into the system. The significance of green critiques is that they suggest that far from being the only viable political economic system, capitalism is in fact primed to destroy the entire Earth environment. The relationship between capitalism and eco-disaster is neither coincidental nor accidental. Capital's need of a constantly expanding market, its growth fetish, means that capital is by its very nature opposed to any notion of sustainability. See, I actually think he's pretty strong when he talks about media in these kinds of ways. That's what the strongest parts of the capitalist realism book.
And then the counter to that is, you said in an earlier discussion that then the weakest parts was when he tried to, outside of that, talk about real-life institutions or something?
He does this thing where I didn't mind the inference he just made here from WALL-E. I don't mind. I didn't mind it, actually, because it's independently verifiable. But there are times when he talks about, and all cultural theorists do this, and literary theorists do this in a way that I used to really like, because I like the idea that you could just, you know, read a Virginia Woolf novel and then infer something about the nature of capitalism or something. When he jumps to like psychology and he talks about like individual lived experience and he talks about institutions and causation, and he infers from his media and cultural analyses these causal facts about that IRL, that's when I find him to be the weakest.
It seems to be like the weakness of cultural critique and its relationship with like psychoanalysis.
And phenomenology.
Yeah, and
like post-structuralism, arguably, too. I mean, I'm not dismissing that. I'm not some reactionary. I'm not dismissing those three things out of hand. I just think that, like,
yeah,
there's a varying degrees at which you can use them successfully. And I think this kind of writing and thinking, it sells really well because it's really, I mean, it just, it makes these complex ideas and esoteric ideas intuitive, and it makes everybody think about politics and culture and in these cool ways. And so whatever, that's an advantage of it, not a weakness, actually.
It's very good for popularization of theory and for teaching it to people, getting the foot in the door, and then you can provide, you know. A thing that I said before was like moving from a pamphlet discussion to a textbook discussion.
Yeah.
Where we can talk on the level of something that I would hand you in a pamphlet, and then we can get down and dirty with the real theory that would be published in that textbook. And they're
textbook itself is still a simplification, right? So you move from the pamphlet to the textbook to the original text to modern papers. That's how I would say it.
back to WALL-E, and like, actually, it's not just WALL-E. It's movies like The Lorax, like any movies that try to talk about the environment, any movies that have a sort of a greedy corporation as the bad guy. A lot of this is an example of what's called interpassivity in the goddamn book. Fisher describes this as our way of performing our anti-capitalism for us. Or at least Fisher says that. Is that a Zizek thing, or?
That's basically Zizek's theory of ideology. Not to be, that's glib, but he gives the example of the Tibetan prayer wheel where you spin it and it prays for you, or a sitcom, it laughs for you, or, you know, and then he relates that to, you know, like chocolate laxatives and diet-free soda, like, you know, it's because it's like...
So then the Lorax does your environmentalism for you is then the connection.
But while also admitting that it's all...
For consumption, which is convenient.
Yes, and admitting that it's all futile. We're at the end of history. We can't do anything anyway. So it's like...
Right. I'm really mad that the Lorax doesn't have any structural critique. Really disappointed.
I mean, I don't like this section, but it's fine or whatever. In illustration, I challenged one student about why he always wore headphones in class. He replied that it didn't matter because he wasn't actually playing any music. Yeah. In another lesson, he was playing music in a very low volume through the headphones without wearing them. When I asked him to switch it off, he replied that he couldn't even hear it. Why wear the headphones without playing music, or play music without wearing the headphones? Because the presence of the phones on the ears of the knowledge that the music is playing, even if he couldn't hear it, was a reassurance that the matrix was still there, within reach. Besides, in a classic example of interpassivity, if the music was still playing, even if he couldn't hear it, then the player could still enjoy it on his behalf. The use of headphones is significant here. Pop is experienced not as something which could have impacts upon public space, but as a retreat into a private, Oedipoid consumer bliss, a walling up against the social. The consequence of being hooked into the entertainment matrix is twitchy, agitated interpassivity, an inability to concentrate or focus. Students' incapacity to connect current lack of focus with future failure, their inability to synthesize time into any coherent narrative, is symptomatic of a more than mere demotivation. In fact, it is eerily reminiscent of Jameson's analysis in Postmodernism and Consumer Society. Jameson observed there that the Lacan's theory of schizophrenia offered a suggested aesthetic model for understanding the fragmenting of subjectivity in the face of emergent entertainment industrial complex. With the breakdown of the signifying chain, the Lacanian schizophrenic is reduced to an experience of pure material signifiers, or in other words, a series of pure and unrelated presence in time. Jameson was writing in the late 1980s, the period in which most of my students were born. What we in the classroom are now facing is a acculturation born into that ahistorical, empty, memnonic blip culture, a generation that is to say, for whom time has always come ready cut into digital micro slices. So, see, this is great, because this passage does exactly, it's with Fisher, it's like, it literally combines his strong and his weakness in one passage. So he does like a good, decent cultural analysis. And then he makes this inference, like, and as we talked about before, and we'll get to probably later, like, social determinants of mental health is, like, a really well-established thing. I mean, it's just, but, like, the specific mechanism he's proposing here is kind of just, like, weird. It's kind of goofy.
I had a big problem with it because with pretentious classical music people, one of the big problems with popular music is that it's played in public just as, like, background noise. And they're like, you're not paying attention to the music. And the classical music people hated that, and they thought that it was proof that it doesn't even count as art anymore. And then, and that's dependent on it just being pop music is like the soup that we swim in public life. But then Fischer starts talking about how pop music is actually about isolation. And I think that that can only really be true if you're talking about an isolation in public, where you exist in public.
That is what he's talking about, though, because he talks about that within the Children of Men, right? Is that it's like they exist in this like place where public space doesn't exist. They're just these, and in WALL-E, you know, if there's public space, there's only these different, it's like this weird thing where it's like we withdraw from public space into our technological apparatuses, whatever, that then connect us to social media and entertainment, which is putatively a form of public as well, but it's a privatized form of public. So we're in public, we retreat from public to go back into the public, but a privatized version thereof. And that's the recurring theme of his analysis of WALL-E, Children of Men, Neuromancer. And I mean, we could probably throw V for Vendetta in there too, because of the presence of the screens and stuff, and the role of like that reality game show or whatever it was on it.
Oh, sure.
And The Matrix, obviously, and like whatever. So sometimes I'm wary of it becoming a little too boomer, like, what if technology, but too much? And like Black Mirror,
exactly, Black Mirror.
Black Mirror is like, it's like a neo-boomer show. It's for the Zoomers who are spiritual boomers.
Yeah.
But I'm a spiritually boomer, Zoomer, but I hate the what if phones, but too much nonsense.
Yeah.
Anyway, at the same time, like, I think it is that he's gesturing at this thing, which is like, how to account for this ever-present role of spectacle, of culture, of the big other, of entertainment, the complete...
What are essentially immobilization factors, right?
Right. And complete fracturing of the public sphere into many privates, and the complete wholesale neoliberalization of everything, like, enclosing the psychic commons, if you will, or, like, enclosing the noosphere or something. To account for its pure dominance and this, what he calls interpassivity and cynicism and inability to act and even just organize and relate to each other in basic way. I think which is a valid point, but it's just, I actually don't know what my thoughts are, because now even talking about it, I'm like, it's becoming more organized in my mind than when I first read it.
Oh, one thing on this is Maria George had a video on Riverdale about the same topic. She brings up some interesting points about that show. Basically, the premise of the show is it's this really trashy teen drama, but it's like it's sort of the so bad it's good kind of stuff. And everyone who watches it and the whole fandom all know it's really bad. It's sort of this thing where they all get to deny their enjoyment of it for it being teen trashy stuff, but they're still enjoying exactly that, right? I thought that was just an interesting point that she brought up.
Well, it's like, okay, so it's like this, something I once said is that, like, the function of shows like Law & Order, SVU, or CSI, I mean, in general crime dramas, is that they allow, you know, the well-ordered, normative, petty bourgeois viewer to indulge in the fucking like lurid and sexual and violent and gross and whatever, because at the end of the episode the moral order of the world is always restored because you get like a punishment of the deviants or whatever, so they get to like they use and it's like there's this very kind of Foucauldian thing where it's like you read these court trials from the medieval era, and these court trials are just like the most like dirty, like licentious, like stuff you like intricate details about like sexuality and body odors and men and just like an absurd like portrayals of, you know, deviant acts or whatever. And you get the impression that everybody wants to engage in this and indulge in the deviants, but in order to do so, they actively condemn and shun it. And like that way they get to participate in deviance while at the same time restoring the moral or maintaining the moral order in the first place. And I think that's actually really true. I mean, actually, like,
there's a reason there are like so many like serial killer documentaries on Netflix, and like, oh god, people who think they're interesting because
so complex, though.
Yeah, no. People who think they themselves are interesting.
Oh,
people.
They're an interesting. Yeah, person. It's just
they're like, oh wow, I'm kind of a sociopath myself. Shut the fuck up. Kills me.
You know what's funny?
Sounds like something that Elon Musk would say. Except he would be right.
It's you know that thread you did about BDSM and kink and sex work the other day.
Yeah.
And you talked about where they'll do the concern troll, where they'll make an expression of disgust, but then we'll brush it aside and pretend that that's not their real motivation or whatever. I think that's the identical phenomenon here, which is this weird obsession with policing sexuality and deeming identity stems from this weird dialectic of wanting to be able to indulge in it while at the same time punishing it and restoring the moral order. And it's interesting because this is an area where, the big people who write on these kinds of topics are people like Nietzsche, Durkheim, and Foucault and stuff. And I think that's actually, there's a real place in this kind of stuff where, especially on questions of deviance and punishment, where those scholars are actually incredibly complementary to a Marxian and a radical analysis of things. And because that's actually, there's a lot of these social dynamics that are autonomous and real and important. Yeah, I don't know. It's just, there's a long tradition about analyzing ideology and culture, but also deviance and punishment that actually really have a strong, because the maintaining of the social order, which is the maintaining of a moral order, is something which consistently in anthropology and sociology and in psychology and so on, is found to be one of the main driving factors of people's behaviors. I mean, just in general. Mm. And even in behavior on evolutionary game theory, it's of importance because
this in little kids policing each other's gender expression and shit like that.
Exactly.
Five years old, these little Nazis are out here screaming about what color pants you have.
I was going to say misogyny, because Kate Mann says misogyny is like the police force of sexism and patriarchy. You're policing the gender identities or whatever in order to maintain this moral order. And this is connected to the fact that a result that's actually not universal, but it's found pretty reliably across different political orientations, because obviously conservative means something different in every culture, but conservatism is very highly associated with a strong disgust reaction. Disgust reactions are strongly disgust reactions are strongly related to notions of purity, danger, Mary Douglas would put it, of the sacred and the profane, of punishment and of the moral order. And with that, actually, this is not too far afield, because this allows us to go back, because the maintaining of the moral order,
narrative comedian who just said, Hitler just was cleaning up. That was Owen Benjamin. He was an epic guy. He said he hated filth. He was just cleaning up.
Yeah. And fascists and conservatives literally believe that. Right. Yeah. And Jason Stanley talks about how propaganda and fascism, it's the language, always the language of pestilence and filth that's used to demonize. And actually, in a study of genocide, CD, that I was reading, they talk about this too. Almost all genocides are preceded by a propaganda campaign which associates that enemy with pestilence and filth. And I think the maintenance of the moral order in this abstract sense, society as such, is one of the main obstacles, one of the main ideological, personal, and psychological obstacles to fundamental social change, whether it be capitalism or patriarchy. And linking this back to Fisher and capitalist realism, neoliberalism, and so on and so forth, is that neoliberalism is the ideological project by which capitalism has been naturalized as the only possible moral and social order. And therefore, even where it's considered distasteful and we want to indulge in its abolition, there's a patent cultural, psychological, ideological block to prevent us from doing so.
Yeah.
And there's also the side benefit that in regards to interpassivity with media gives the sense that so long as we consume the right things, we're okay. Right.
And that's liberalism in general.
Yeah. This is tied into the Live 8 fundraiser, in which basically I think is he quoting Zizek or is it Fisher himself? I can literally never tell in this book.
But he's saying it's himself. I think. Well, I'll find it. Just yeah.
Sure, sure.
Oh yeah, it's his own idea. Yeah.
Yeah, it's basically this idea that it's this analysis of how these protests end up functioning, or you can barely call that a protest, but basically it seems like what's in the minds of the people attending is that they need to make their voices heard mm-hmm. to the infinite resource having eternal figure that is just too mean to make the world a better place, right?
Live 8 was a strange kind of protest, a protest that everybody could agree with. Who actually wants poverty? And it's not that Live 8 was a degraded form of protest. On the contrary, it was in Live 8 that the logic of protest was revealed in its purest form. The protest impulse of the 60s posited a malevolent father, the harbinger of the reality principle that supposedly cruelly and arbitrarily denies the right to total enjoyment. This father has unlimited access to resources, but he selfishly and senselessly hoards them. Yet it is not capitalism, but protest itself, which depends upon this figuration of the father. And one of the successes of the current global elite has been their avoidance of identification with the figure of the hoarding father, even though the reality they impose on the young is substantially harsher than the conditions they protested against in the 60s. Indeed, it was of the course that I don't like this line, but it was, of course, the global elite itself in the form of entertainers such as Richard Curtis and Bono, which organized the Live Aid event. I'm sorry, they're rich and famous, but they're not global elites in a sense that's like meaningful. We could kill them all and it would not have a
single...
Can
we talk about how Mark Fisher is just a huge boomer talking about how the difference between back in when we had Nirvana and the difference between that and rap music?
He doesn't seem to like Nirvana, though. Because he said that Nirvana is like the first, like, thing of this.
He doesn't like Nirvana. He shows that Nirvana like leads to rap music, if I remember the passage correctly.
Alternative and independent don't designate something outside mainstream culture. Rather, they are styles, in fact, the dominant styles within mainstream. I think that's actually a really good point, how cultural protest is always co-opted by the capitalist system. Like, you know, it's like épater le bourgeois, like upsetting bourgeois norms, like surrealism and Dadaism. But those are immediately became commodified. All theater of the absurd, it all just became immediately just like accepted into this particular set. Anyway, no one embodied and struggled with this deadlock more than Kurt Cobain and Nirvana. In his dreadful lassitude and objectless rage, Cobain seemed to give weird voice to the dependency of the generation that had come after history, whose every move was anticipated, tracked, bought, and sold before it even happened. Cobain knew that he was just another piece of the spectacle, that nothing runs better on MTV than a protest against MTV, knew that his every move was a cliche scripted in advance, that even realizing it is a cliche, the impasse that paralyzed Cobain is precisely the one that James had described. Like postmodern culture in general, Cobain found himself in a world in which stylistic innovation is no longer possible, where all that is left is to imitate dead styles, to speak through the masks, and with the voices of the styles in the imaginary museum. Here, the existential angst of Nirvana belongs to an older moment. What succeeded them was a pastiche rock, which produced the forms of past without anxiety. When he died, rock was... here it is. When he died, rock was already eclipsed by hip-hop, whose global success has presupposed just the kind of pre-corporation by capital which I have alluded to above. For much hip-hop, any naive hope that youth culture could change anything has been replaced by a hard-headed embracing of the brutally reductive version of reality. In hip-hop...
He doesn't listen...
He doesn't listen to hip-hop.
But he the idea that stylistic innovation is impossible is weird for the 90s. I don't know. Maybe he's just talking like within rock music, but I don't know.
Because rap itself is a stylistic innovation. But
yeah, nothing's possible except the new stuff that's bad.
Right. First, it means authentic. This is what he says. He's quoting Simon Reynolds from 1996 essay in the Wire magazine. First, it means authentic, uncompromised music that refuses to sell out to the music industry and stop this... Okay. He's very confusing about the reference here. Okay. real has two meanings. First, it means authentic, uncompromised music that refuses to sell out to the music industry. It also signifies that the music reflects a reality constituted by late capitalist economic instability, institutionalized racism, and increased surveillance and harassment of youth by the police. Real means the death of the social. It means corporations who respond to increased profits, not by raising pay or improving benefits, but by downsizing. In the end, it was precisely hip-hop's performance of this first version of the real, the uncompromised thing, that enabled its easy absorption into the second reality of late capitalist economic instability, where such authenticity has proved and highly marketable. Gangster rap merely reflects pre-existing social conditions, as many of its advocates claim, nor does it simply cause those conditions, as its critics argue. It doesn't cause it. Rather, the circuit whereby hip-hop and late capitalist social field feed into each other is the ones by which capitalist realism transforms itself into a kind of anti-mythical myth. The affinity between hip-hop and gangster movies such as Scarface, The Godfather films, Reservoir Dogs, Goodfellas, and Pulp Fiction arises from their common claim to have stripped the world of sentimental illusions to be seen for what it really is, a Hobbesian war of all against all, a system of perpetual exploitation and generalized criminality. See, this is a shitty analysis of hip-hop, but it's an actually okay inference about protest culture in general.
Right.
Says the same neo-noir worldview can be found in the comic books of Frank Miller and in the novels of James Ellroy. There's a kind of machismo of demythologization in their works. It poses unflinching observers. In his Pitch Blackness, Mike Davis wrote of Ellroy 92, "There is no light left to cast shadows, and evil becomes a forensic banality. The result feels very much like an actual moral texture of the Reagan-Bush era, a supersaturation of corruption that fails any longer outrage or even interest. Yet this very desensitization serves a function for capitalist realism." Davis hypothesized that the role of L.A. Noir may have been to endorse the emergence of a homo Reaganus. Yes, it's funny. I mean, I have a lot to say about noir and neo-noir and Elroy in particular, but that's for, and Mike Davis, but that's for another day, I think.
No homo Reaganus.
Anyway, it's like, you know, and I, you know, this is like something I used to joke because I say authenticity is just something that was invented to sell greeting cards, basically. I mean, I actually agree with that. And free will is a similar ideology. It's like it's meant to justify punishment, among other things. I mean, that's more controversial, but I think the fact that authenticity and free will and anti-commodification as a cultural thing are so easily commodified and turned into these sentimental ideologies. And there's two books I wish we had read along with this because they're so relevant. One is, I've talked about it with y'all before, it's the Harcourt book, Illusions of Free Markets. Yeah. So he traces the idea of the birth of the idea of the natural order of the market was always a punitive and disciplinary idea that was tied to strong views about, again, the moral order, punishment, retribution, and deviance. Mm-hmm. And he talks about how, in practice, the spread of capitalism and especially neoliberalism.
See all those same lines in like Fox News, like
all the time. About,
like, why do poor people have refrigerators?
The modern category of liberty emerged in reaction to an earlier integrated version of punishment and political public economy, known in the 18th century as police. So he shows how the spread of capitalism has, and especially neoliberalism, has always been spread by the, has been accompanied or preceded by the spread of carceralism and the prison system. And the other person who makes the same argument and actually says so much stuff that's convergent with Fisher in very cool ways is my favorite Bay historian of economic thought, Murawski. And he wrote this book called Never Let a Serious Crisis Go to Waste. And it's about how in 2007, the neoliberal dominant ideology was shown to be absolute, not on its own terms, to be absolute horseshit, right? It was not able to technocratically and expertisely predict or maintain anything. It failed completely, whatever. But it's not only did it persist, it got stronger. And so he says, he tries to account how that happened. I mean, when everybody, even in the mainstream papers, you had people talking about Marx, and you had Alan Greenspan admitting he was wrong, and Paul Volcker admitting he was wrong, and Larry Summers admitting he was wrong. You had all of these things. And his book is, he's actually written 5 books on this subject. It's like one of his unifying things. He has one called Science Mart about commodifying science, and he has a, what about the road from Mount Pelerin about the birth of neoliberalism? And his history is, why does a serious crisis never go to waste? It's a very amazing book. He starts with the freaking Mount Pelerin, I always get it, with like, you know, Hayek, Mises, Buchanan, Friedman, Popper, briefly Polanyi, and all these ordo liberals and these other people, and how they came together and they literally said, let's do the vanguardist model of the Marxians works. This is what you should do. So we're going to create a capitalist vanguard, and we're going to slowly but surely, we're going to get the sucker of these big corporations and capitalists, and we're going to win on several domains by taking over the broader culture, the academic culture, the public opinion, also literally policy and politics. It literally fucking worked. And like, they really quickly got funding. And all of a sudden you had these foundations, these dark wing money, you know, that fund universities and schools and grants. And you had the creation out of nowhere of these Austrian economics departments, like at George Mason. You had the rise of these, like the Liberty Fund and that Smith Institute and the Mises and the Cato and the da-da-da-da-da. And you had all of this stuff. You had the spread of, you know, Ayn Rand and Hayek and whatever. And you had them writing letters to each other, literally saying, like, we have to be obfuscatory because we have to keep people basically stupid and have to have, like, a stupid version of our ideas. And they were wrote in this almost, like, contemptuous way of the populace. And all this stuff. And actually, he also documents, you know, internal resistance to this. Popper quit. Polanyi quit. And documents, you know, they're first with Reagan and Thatcher and, you know, Deng Xiaoping, and this links it to like the David Harvey account of neoliberalism and possibly the Jameson and their entrenchment, their takeover of economics, their vast proliferation of neoclassical economics in other guises. So through evolutionary psychology and sociobiology and different evolutionary accounts, through market behavior and market design, through rational actor theory, through the economics of crime, through whatever, they slowly, you know, this disciplinary imperialism, they invaded every other social science and humanities and got immense traction among it.
These and they believe their own bullshit too, which is like,
some of them,
like,
do. Some of
well,
them
kind
do.
Of, but it's like, so you brought up the point about them having this spiteful shit towards, like...
Okay, so Varoufakis has a story about, I forget which architect of neoclassical economics he attended a lecture of. And after the lecture, the economist the lecturer said something along the lines, in response to a question, he said something along the lines of, you're confusing what is interesting with what can be applied to reality. Talking about, you know, the dominant form of economic theory. Mm-hmm. It's like at the top, they don't actually believe it. It's just everyone
not anymore.
I think like there's a certain way they still justify it to themselves. Yeah, and what I was trying to get at is like, so there's this spiteful view of the people that they're trying to sell this bullshit to. On some level, like all of them are just like, if they just fucking consumed the right way, if they just acted the right way, if these stupid little people, these stupid little consumers just acted the right way, things would be fine.
Yes, right? And that's why they tie it to the project of the prison system. Rask talks about this.
Yeah.
Because the idea is that if you fall within the bounds of rationality, consume and act the right way in the capitalist order, you're fine. But then you need to have this fucking incredibly strong state power force that's literally just going to crush anybody who deviates from it even slightly. That's why he says the neoliberals totally abandoned their opposition to the state. They were no longer done with it. They're opportunistic about it. They would openly criticize it, but they would actively advocate regulation and government intrusion in some aspects in the prison system and punishment. And see, it's actually the solid time together very nicely because – and Murawski has a second book that came out recently, The Knowledge We Have Lost in Information, and he actually talks about the fact that they don't believe their own stuff. And I've, you know, it's funny. Like I study the sociology of economic knowledge. I go to these economics conferences, whatever, and it's very clear that they don't. The talks will be. They'll give talks where they excoriate the theory of like, you know, supply and demand or whatever, market efficiency. That, you know, it'll be like a memorial lecture by this or whatever. And then and Danny Roderick, of all people, is political economist from Harvard or now Princeton, I think. He wrote in his most recent book on trade and stuff. He talks about how he talked to other economists. And he says, you all full well know that free trade theory is not really true, that the distributional effects are totally undercut any gains, and the theory of comparative advantage is not really sustained, especially with mobile factors, institutional issues, and so on. And the economists all say, of course we know that. And they say, why do you do that? And he says, well, because the common people's preference towards government intrusion into trade and stuff is so strong that if we gave it any legitimation, they'd go too far the other direction. So if we want to maintain it, we have to tell the public one thing and they'll meet us in the middle. I mean, that's a total self-delusional view. And Murawski talks about knowledge, we lost the information. Like, they don't really believe their own stuff. And then it's actually very interesting the way this all links together, actually. I think it's cool because the Varoufakis book, The Great Minotaur, it's an awesome history of the contemporary economics of the neoliberal order. So is the book Secrets of the Temple by the Federal Reserve. And then Murawski gives the fucking awesome intellectual and social and organizational history. And what is it? David Harvey gives just the standard political economy history. And all of this together, you know, ties in, I think, with this Zizekian and this Fisherian and this Jamesian points, actually all very quite nicely. They tie together in a very interesting, cool way. Oh, and Graeber's Utopia of Rules, I think, and Bullshit Jobs. I think these all function as nice little constellation, which allows us to link all of these different ideas, the capitalism, the ideology, the moral order, the culture, the indifference, the naturalization of neoliberalism, the public assertions of the demise of the state, while it's incredible ramping up and bureaucratization and so on, the ideas of the end of history. I mean, it's just like they all link together in this very interesting and profoundly consistent and coherent way. And this brings me back, though, to the beginning. Remember, I was saying, I think people have a harder time imagining some other things in the end of capitalism, but if we want to all tie it together, Nitzan and Bichler basically say we shouldn't even divide the state and capital conceptually. Capitalization is just what the state does. I don't know if I agree with that, but that framework actually is pretty useful because then it allows us to just be like, there is no abolishing capitalism without abolishing the state. But anyway, I think all of this links together to why it is so hard for people to imagine the end of capitalism and all this other stuff. Because of the sacredness of this moral order, the success of its cultural ideological project, which also has been an incredibly profoundly powerful disciplinary institutional policy project. So it affected, you know, they did a dual assault against, you know, the superstructure and the base at the same time. You know what I mean? They weren't taking any chances. they weren't taking chances with regard to theories of history. So they just went for both at the same time. You know, it's just the neoliberals and how profoundly successful they were. I mean, their way of rethink notions like authenticity and stuff.
It's ultimately abundantly clear when you talk to Austrians and stuff like that. It's all founded on insecurity. They absolutely need to show that capitalism is the only thing. It's the only realistic thing that we can possibly talk about. And then I think Fisher takes it from there and goes to talk about, well, then in that case, we should show how it is absolutely not realistic. We need to meet them on their own terms and prove it. And he goes into three examples of why it's not sustainable. The first being environmental.
And you know, this is literally Murawski's career now. This is literally what he's, you know, started off as just a historian of economic thought and math and all these other things. I mean, literally probably most perspicacious historian of thought I've ever read, actually. But now he's entirely talks about, because it's just it's his personal thing. He wants it to see it fucking die. So he's just he doesn't necessarily have hopes for it. So he ties this paper recently called, I'll send it to you. It's a great, it's a YouTube video too. Hell is Truth, Seen Too Late. And he talks about the enclosure of the academic and scientific commons as being one of these, despite it being the place where neoliberalism was birthed in this new kind of way, at least ideologically, it's their last place of enclosure. And everybody's welcoming in the neoliberalization and enclosure of the scientific commons under the exact opposite premise. Anyway, that's his thing. And his whole point is that, it's been laid bare that this is all nonsense, both empirically and in people's experience. But not only that, in the works of these peoples themselves, I mean, at least in the academic stuff, the popularization of it never existed. And he talks about the central contradiction. It's if markets are super efficient, then why do economists need to exist, right? So, right? If they're perfect on their own, why do they need to exist? So he talks about the rise of these things like market behavior and market design. So now it becomes, once you get a smart economist to come in and institutionally design through the right norms, metrics, and information, the correct market and have implemented through state policy, then the market will take over and be super efficient or whatever. So now they get to have it both ways. They get to be, they get to keep eating and they get this free market, whatever. That tacitly admits that markets and stuff have to be designed and made and enforced. They're not pre-existing things. People don't realize how successful the project of hegemony is. I mean, I guess it'd be weird. It's weird to call it the project of it because it's just always there. At least this specific version of it. You don't have to believe in an idealistic, liberal, affirmational view of the world to understand that having our cultural, social, entertainment, psychological, and moral world completely commonized and enclosed and taken over, and technological world taken over by these ideologies and these architects of them, is not going to be fucking good for either ourselves or for revolution or anything. Fisher himself, though, falls into the bourgeois idealist trap, I think, some of the times, when it goes too far the other direction and it only focuses on these cultural and moral things. You know?
So, yeah, one thing I have issue with is it fits really well, right? The idea that, oh, you know, we can just meet them on their own terms and show capitalism to not be realistic. And that's like, it's so effective in one-on-one conversation. I have such an easy time doing this myself, talking about how the contradictions of capital are going to lead to its demise. As soon as I can get the conversation towards that direction, everything just falls naturally and it's really easy.
Even with conservatives, really you can convinced. Do it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. With anyone. My favorite people to talk to, the people I consider the easiest to talk to, are libertarians, not the fascist kind, the five of them that are like,
yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I know exactly.
You know?
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
These are the easiest conversations in the world. And even the ones that, okay, have you noticed this phenomenon of the libertarian, person who identifies as a libertarian, but says, I wish Bernie had won?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Wait, what? What are you talking about? Like, you know, well, it's like,
even like Penn Jillette said something like that.
What they're expressing a lot of the time is this idea that they don't like that they're not being represented, right?
And yeah, then anyway,
from there, it's very easy to say, oh, well, why aren't you represented, right? These conversations end up being really easy on an individual level.
Yeah, but they have no scale or scalability.
Yeah. And that's my concern with a lot of his prescriptions. They fit really nicely. They work really well with the thesis of the book. But I'm not sure how they scale.
That's the problem with, you know, liberalism in general and the way it's sort of taken over even the left. When you see discussions of advocates of nonviolence and of pacifism, you know, they often talk as if we could just go around and convince every Nazi not to be a Nazi, you know, like through personal discussion. I mean, surely if you devoted enough time and energy to convincing one of them, you'll do it. But, you know, at great risk and cost to yourself and over a very long fucking period of time. And as long as the Nazi org still exists, they're going to pump them out faster than you can convert them back.
The one thing is, just to kind of half counter this, there is the idea of sincerity used in a certain way that can actually be subversive. I think if you've ever seen Non-Compete, he goes into this really well. You'll meet some people who their sincerity, your immediate reaction is like, what, you're wasting your time, like what are you doing? But like if it's in certain ways it can be like surprisingly effective and catch people off guard. So I think there's something there, but I'm not sure how to utilize it.
Well, Foucault would talk this like paresia, like it's speaking your truth, speaking plainly, speaking your truth, not necessarily to power because truth and power are co-constitutive. But like the problem with that, I think, is that the concept of sincerity is quite like the concept of authenticity and that it's a commodified, it becomes a sentimental commodity used to do exactly its opposite. You know what I mean? So
sure, at scale for sure.
For me, the ideal model is to be like serious and take things seriously, but not be self-serious. And so not take yourself very seriously, you know,
sure.
No one succeeds at that, but that's the most convincing person. I mean, in my opinion, the closest people who do achieve that, I mean, you know, we don't have to like them, but they're good at what they do. I think are people like these popularizers. I mean, I have a lot of problems with putting them, so whatever it's like, but like Zizek or Chomsky or whatever, they're the master of combining their own self-deprecation and just total self-abandonment with this committed belief in what they're actually talking about. The neoliberals, they only have one response. It's always a hypocritical version. Oh, you're a leftist, yet you own an iPhone, or oh, da 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 da. Right? Yeah. That's like their only response, right? So when these people come along, and they don't get riled up, like when you attack them or mock them personally or whatever, they are very successful at least getting people into these ideas. I don't know. They're not scalable and they're not right. Right. But like, whatever, there's actually a method to their madness or whatever. But then the opposite spectrum, you have the very self-serious people who are not serious whatsoever. It's so funny because it's always the thing and it's opposite. So this is both the trad left, DSA, Smashing on Steel, Matt Breunig types, and their main target of criticism, the woke gold liberal rad lib stereotype. This is both the weird internet ML with
who supposes themselves to be the next Che.
Like. Exactly. Or the pre-cultural planning theorist. Much love to y'all too, but like, you know, the the other of the self-serious ML who fancies themselves an eccentric planner is the self-serious leftcom who fancies themselves the next Marx. All right. Right. What you tell these people is these four groups, right? Is that, and we all do this, right? So I'm not exempting myself from the problem of self-seriousness, right? It's like, that would be absurd, but we all have fragile egos and imposter complex issues. It's irrelevant. These types of people, they violently enforce it, right? So if you challenge their self-appointed status or label as expert or something on something, then that's like the worst sin in their book. And they immediately pounce with great speed and whatever. And it's really made bad by the existence of social media. It worsens that in so many ways.
So easy.
And that is the least effective form of recruitment that could ever exist. And it actually brings us to another Mark Fisher essay, which I'm going to bring up, which y'all have read, the Vampire Castle one.
Oh, sure. I don't think I've gotten around to that one, have you?
Oh, I've had it.
So exiting the Vampire Castle, I think it's funny because his two enemies in the thing are, he says, anarchists and something else. It's like funny because I actually agree with his analysis, but I would totally reverse his who he blames for it. But the idea is, here we go. He says the law of the Vampire Castle. One, the first law of the Vampire Castle is individualize and privatize everything. While in theory it claims to be in favor of structural critique, in practice, it never focuses on anything except individual behavior. Some of these working class types are not terribly well brought up and can be very rude. Remember, condemning individuals is always more important than paying attention to impersonal structure. The actual ruling class propagates ideologies of individualism while tending to act as a class. The Vampire Castle, the dupe citizens of the ruling class, does the opposite. It pays lip service to solidarity and collectivity while always acting as if the individual's categories imposed by power really hold. Because they are petit bourgeois to the core, the members of the Vampire Castle are intensely competitive, but this is repressed in the passive-aggressive manner typical of the bourgeoisie. What holds them together is not solidarity, but mutual fear, the fear that they will be the next one to be outed, exposed, and condemned. The second law of the Vampire Castle is, make thought and action appear very, very difficult. There must be no lightness and certainly no humor. Humor isn't serious by definition, right? Thought is hard work for people with posh voices and furrowed brows. Where there's confidence, introduce skepticism. Say, don't be hasty. We have to think more deeply about this. Remember, having convictions is oppressive and might lead to gulags. The third law of Vampire Castle is propagate as much guilt as you can. The more guilt, the better. People must feel bad. It's a sign that they understand the gravity of things. It's okay to be class privileged if you feel guilty about privilege and make others in a subordinate class position to you feel guilty too. You do some good works for the poor too, right? Fourth law of the Vampire Castle is essentialize. While fluidity of identity, plurality, and multiplicity are always claimed on behalf of the VC members, partly to cover up their own burning wealthy, privileged, or bourgeois assimilationist background, the enemy is always too centralized. Since the desires animating the VC are in large part the priest's desires to excommunicate and condemn, this is the moral order thing I was talking about, there has to be a strong distinction between good and evil, with the latter essentialized. Notice the tactics. Their whole identity, because I actually don't agree. I think this is a stupid thing because he's a very boomer comment. He says next, notice the tactics. X has made a remark, was behaved in a particular way. These remarks and behavior might be construed as transphobic and sexist. So far, okay. But the next move, which is the kicker, X then becomes defined as transphobic and sexist. I get what he's going for there, but it's just
totally
silly comment.
I totally agree. Yeah, that I see that like all the time. So,
Once the VC has mustered its wish hunt, the victim, often from a working class man, can be reliably goaded into losing their temper, further securing their position as pariah leaders to be consumed in convening frenzy. Again, I agree with what he's saying, but he's a really shitty example. I don't agree. Anyway, the fifth law of the Vampire Castle is think like a liberal because you are one. The VC's workup of constantly stoking up reactive outrage consists of endlessly pointing out the screamingly obvious. Capital behaves like capital. It's not very nice. Repressive state apparatuses are repressive. We must protest. All right, there we go.
Yeah. We'll have these criticisms of his prescriptions, but I think we should probably talk about those prescriptions as well, right? So there's one, the trying to point out the contradiction in capital and the environment, which he doesn't go into too much depth in because that's already a field of contention. But then there are two others, if I recall correctly.
Anyway, also I'm trying to find two other articles that are really consonant with this. There's an Angela Davis essay where she criticizes modern liberal demonstrations, and there's a the Marx essay against moralism. I think all of these actually fit together very well, nice. See, this is a conversation actually making me like Mark Fisher more than I did before. But it's it's funny. Let's see where is where is the? Oh come on.
And you don't seem to understand.